So the title of this talk is Mapping McCarthy in the Age of Neoconservatism. It could have been about No Country for Old Men, but I'd like to focus today on the road. And one of the things I'd like to do with this paper is suggest that certain facets of McCarthy's style and some of the themes which have structured his prose for decades might need to be rethought critically, given the context of McCarthy's later work in the War on Terror and the age of neoconservatism in the US. One example of this might be McCarthy's treatment of violence, which again appears in The Road as something akin to a natural law or a state of nature. The post-apocalyptic landscapes of The Road are suffused with cosmic violence. Lightning strikes, thunder, firestorms, earthquakes erupt continually throughout the book and seem presented to the reader in a continuum with the innate primal violence of the human animal in its most reduced, primitive, and pre-social form. In The Road, when the artificial restraints of order and authority are gone, the immediate lapse into barbarism appears to confirm a long-standing suspicion that in the universe as viewed poetically by Cormac McCarthy, violence and domination are not simply contingent aspects of the human condition, they are the lodestone, the essence, the irreducible existential core of all existence, including human existence. Questions about violence in McCarthy are nothing new, but my concern here isn't so much moral or existential as it is political. While McCarthy is writing The Road, the influence of neoconservatism in Washington has turned US foreign policy decisively away from diplomacy and détente, and decisively toward the master and slave dynamics of massive power projection and colossal military violence. The age of conservatism in the US has, as one of its defining features, an entirely doctrinal assertion that in a post-Cold War context of American hyperpower, pursuing diplomacy and abiding by the artificial restraints of international law are the watchwords of the weak and a betrayal of national values. In 2006, the same year that McCarthy publishes The Road, the medical journal The Lancet published a report estimating that around 655,000 Iraqis, or one in 40 of the country's population, had died as a direct consequence of the US invasion, an invasion led by neoconservatives whose core policy recommendations since the late 1990s had included, among other things, a vast upscaling of American military capabilities to fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theatre wars, an ambition extending way beyond domination of the terrestrial sphere to control of the new international commons of space, to pave the way for the creation of a new military service, US Space Forces, with the mission of space control. What should we make politically of McCarthy's treatment of violence in a context such as this? What should we think about a novel like The Road, which turns violence and domination into primordial truths in a period where massive military violence is embraced as a virtuous extension of American values, freedoms, and rights? This paper will try to answer these questions by identifying some of the ways, anyway, in which McCarthy's The Road might resonate alarmingly with what I'm going to call the neoconservative structure of feeling that is ascendant in the US in the years immediately after 9/11. The paper will argue what, for me, is a rather uncomfortable proposition, that McCarthy's prose in The Road acts as a nodal point or a lightning stick through which neoconservative values can be felt with particular luminescence and force. The phrase I'm using to gather this argument together, structure of feeling, comes from Raymond Williams, who first used the term back in the 1950s in an attempt to develop and elaborate older, more rigid, more clumsy understandings of ideology as codified in the Marxian tradition. In Williams, a structure of feeling connotes a set of values, beliefs, and perceptions that are widely shared by and within a particular generation, with varying degrees of commitment or self-awareness. For the most part, the phrase implies values that are felt rather than values that are known, values that are sensed or intuited as part of daily lived experience, rather than values that are coherently or systematically articulated and elaborated. When Williams uses the phrase structure of feeling, he's talking very specifically about the now, about how we process the world as we encounter it in a stream of contemporary experience. Structures of feeling, Williams suggests, are social experiences in solution. They articulate values which, by definition, are still emerging, still forming, still coming into being. Commitments and beliefs that are inchoate, incomplete, ambiguous, provisional, and open-ended. I think this is important because it helps underline another point that I probably need to make at the outset. When I suggest that McCarthy's prose in the road embodies, disseminates, and assists in the naturalising of a neoconservative structure of feeling, one thing I'm definitely not doing is making claims about authorial intent. What I'm really interested in here is the reception of McCarthy's work, or at least the range of possible receptions of that work by readers. The ideological uses, conscious or otherwise, to which contemporary readers might put McCarthy's prose in a specific historical time and place. When I suggest that The Road might be read as one manifestation of the neoconservative structure of feeling that prevails in the US after 9/11, I don't mean that readers might use the book to support directly or willfully the invasion of Iraq or the torture, an extraordinary rendition of terrorist suspects. What I mean is that contemporary American readers in context, at the height of a domestic neoconservative insurgency, in an era of foreign wars and unrestrained military violence, might sense in The Road, at the inchoate level of feeling, an affirmation of neocon values, beliefs and commitments. One way of opening this discussion up might be to dwell briefly on the representation of 9/11, which begins taking shape as the official neocon narrative in President Bush's historic speech to a joint session of Congress 9 days after the attacks on September 20th, 2001. And then, having done that, to point up some possible parallels in McCarthy's own post-apocalypse. In his address to Congress, the speech in which he first declares a war on terror, Bush presents 9/11 as an inexplicable, motiveless, irrational surprise attack, a moment of apocalyptic violence which cannot be processed intellectually because it has no clear cause or rationale beyond a visceral hatred of the American way. In place of historical or political contexts, or an intellectual framework in which we might explain and understand 9/11, in Bush's depiction of events, there is a calculated appeal instead to the gut, to emotion, to nationalism and the myth of national mission, and to the redemptive use of vengeful military violence. In place of a rational examination of causes and contexts, we might say, there is an appeal to sentiment, to anger, fear, and loathing. Underwriting all this is the suggestion that everything has changed. In a world transformed by apocalyptic terror, the old rules no longer apply. On the evening of September 11, 2001, as Bush puts it in his address to Congress, quote, night fell on a different world. The older restraints no longer apply. New rules, new guides to conduct must be invented. Bush's rendition of 9/11 to Congress presents us with a vision of inexplicable terror and existential threats that chimes quite harmoniously, I'd like to suggest, with the resolutely opaque and inexplicable apocalypse in the road, an event which is similarly characterised by an absence of clear contexts or causes, by the displacement of intellect by sentiment, and by the presentation of circumstances in which new guides to conduct must necessarily and justifiably take the place of values and actions which are now obsolete. In this respect, in the opaque and inexplicable nature of McCarthy's apocalypse, the road actually departs quite significantly from tradition and genre. Whatever its setting in some imagined future, the apocalyptic imagination in Western literary history has always articulated very contemporary anxieties and concerns. The original meaning of apocalypse in its Greek usage refers to a moment of revelation, a moment in which previously hidden truths would be uncovered, unveiled, or revealed. By shining a revelatory light on the destructive or self-destructive qualities of society, apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic representation allows us to see clearly, perhaps for the first time, truths about society which might otherwise, in the normal run of things, remain hidden or obscure. As the critic James Berger puts it, apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic narrative, I'm quoting here, must in its destructive moment clarify and illuminate the true nature of what has been brought to an end. From the Book of Revelation's condemnation of Babylon, through the millenarian movements of the Middle Ages, to more recent apocalyptic thinking, both religious and secular, visions of the end and its aftermath, Berger writes, emphasise that no social reform can cure the world's diseases. The existing world is so suffused with moral rottenness and technological, political, and economic chaos that it should end, and it must end. Perhaps the most striking facet of McCarthy's post-apocalypse, when it's situated generically and traditionally in this way, is that it does none of these things. If anything, the road appears actively to refuse the moment of revelation that conventionally lies at the core of the apocalyptic imagination. Readers who come to the novel looking for a revelatory light shone brightly on the causes of the end of the world will be disappointed. There is no clear or overt indictment of technology or capitalism or moral rottenness of any obvious kind, no causal links established between destructive forces peculiar to the old world and the desolation of the new. It's become conventional to see the end of the world in the road as an environmental cataclysm, or a meteor strike, or a nuclear holocaust, and critics and students will assert these causes with varying degrees of confidence and certainty. But the thing that makes each of these different speculative readings possible is that the novel in the end simply refuses to tell. Where generically we might expect to find the clarifying light of revelation, in the road we find only a hermeneutic murkiness, an apocalypse that is sufficiently dense, opaque, and unreadable to have made speculation about its causes a perennial issue in critical discussion of the book. It's a scenario, I'd suggest, that bears more than a passing resemblance to President Bush's rendition of 9/11 as an inexplicable and contextless attack. Also much like the neocon narrative about 9/11, in place of a rational or intellectual response to catastrophe, highlighting causes, contexts, explanations, the literary power of the road, to me, seems essentially visceral or sentimental. Throughout, the focus is on the terror of the child and the father's emotive processing of that terror. Stripped of context and an explanatory frame of reference, the reader is more or less compelled to fill in the gaps with her own emotional fantasies and fears. In both cases, the neocon story about 9/11 and the post-apocalyptic story of the road, the narrative doesn't really work to its fullest, most powerful extent unless the reader does this. In this respect, some of the most telling critical responses to the book might be those very early suggestions widely offered, for example, on the discussion boards of the McCarthy Society Forum, which suggested that The Road, more than anything McCarthy has written, is a very hard book to read emotionally. Such is the sentimental force that McCarthy engineers in the relationship between the father and the child and in the relationship between the reader and the characters. The diamond-hard prose of the book stops The Road functioning as melodrama, but the narrative focus on raw emotion, heightened pathos, family trauma, certainly makes something like melodrama a significant generic presence in the novel. I use the term trauma here advisedly. Not surprisingly, given its historical context, McCarthy's ability to conjure the experience of intense and overwhelming trauma in prose has been widely noted in critical responses to the book. One of the more influential of these was Richard Gray's essay, Open Doors, Closed Minds, an essay which celebrates The Road as one of very few novels to have succeeded in representing and embodying artistically the very particular moment of historical trauma experienced by Americans during and after the 9/11 attacks. Drawing on trauma theory, Gray finds in The Road's opaque and visceral apocalypse a profoundly truthful representation of trauma, whose fidelity to the novel's moment in time lies precisely, he argues, in trauma's inexpressible and unrepresentable nature. The experience of trauma, Gray suggests, is overwhelming and debilitating, partly because, in its early stages, the traumatic event cannot be coherently articulated, the horror of the moment overriding and circumventing the subject's ability to process it cognitively and to express it in language. In order to begin moving beyond the paralyzing effects of trauma, the traumatized subject must first integrate the traumatic event holistically within consciousness and experience. And the first step in this therapeutic process may therefore involve bringing the trauma to language by situating it within narrative. For Gray, the genius of McCarthy's novel is that it represents and embodies trauma in its very early stages, before trauma is brought fully to consciousness, before it can be coherently explained, articulated, and expressed, before trauma exists on any level other than as a totalizing, overwhelming, static, and permanent presence in the experience of the traumatized subject. Put differently, the way Richard Gray sees it, in The Road, it is the very absence of therapeutic narrative in the form of causes, contexts, or explanations for the end of the world that allows the novel to embody so profoundly the feeling of trauma that characterises its moment in time. Gray's essay offers an important and influential reading of The Road, but it's also, I think, a problematic reading, not least because the novel's stalling of the reader's experience in trauma is so ideologically charged in a political context governed by the post-9/11 neoconservative structure of feeling. The neocon narrative about 9/11 depends for its success on a very similar fixing and freezing of events within the early stages of traumatic experience, before the traumatic events of 9/11 can be integrated into consciousness and articulated in narrative. Stripped of explanatory narrative, post-9/11 neocon rhetoric is characterised instead by a compulsive return to the original moment of trauma, to the time and place of the primal wound, first to the morning of September 11 itself, then to the empty, gaping absence or wound of ground zero. Neocon narrative is anti-narrative, narrative that stalls permanently in the original experience of trauma, just as McCarthy's novel, its protagonists and many of its early readers seemed gripped or transfixed within the overwhelming experience of trauma the novel so artfully conveys. In this respect, again, I'd suggest we might conceive The Road less as Gray wishes to see it, as a generalised embodiment of a moment in time, and more as a very particular, very visceral embodiment of a post-9/11 neoconservative structure of feeling. Another much-discussed aspect of The Road and another aspect of the narrative that might chime harmoniously with the values of contemporary neoconservatism is the novel's identification of entropy as the chronic condition of the world, a world, McCarthy tells us in one of the book's more widely quoted passages, that is shrinking down about a raw core of passable entities, the names of things slowly following those things into oblivion, colours, the names of birds, things to eat, finally the names of things one believed to be true, a world drawing down like something trying to preserve heat in time to wink out forever. Entropy is entrenched aesthetically in the novel in formal, thematic, and generic ways. Entropy is present in the novel's discussion of language and memory fading from the world. Entropy is figured generically in the implicit exhaustion of the road narrative, and perhaps in the novel's refusal of revelation, in the implicit exhaustion of the apocalyptic narrative as well. Entropy is figured formally in the absence of chapter breaks, so the narrative, like Samuel Beckett's Endgame, becomes a single structure or aesthetic pulse slowly winding down to an end. And entropy is figured too in the other writers McCarthy appears self-consciously to echo, whose work appears intertextually in The Road, sedimented into McCarthy's own post-apocalypse, T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, Fitzgerald's Valley of Ashes, the unreadable apocalyptic landscapes at the beginning of Hemingway's Big Two-Hearted River, or On the Quay at Smyrna. For each of these writers, modernity means the obliteration of the past, entrenched entropy and cultural sterility, where language is shattered and the memory of a richer, more secure past is fading, problematic, illusory, or unknowable. Entrenched entropy is also the chronic condition of the world in the political philosophy of Leo Strauss, the thinker most commonly identified as the primary intellectual influence on 21st century neoconservatism. More specifically, in Strauss, entrenched entropy is the chronic condition of modern Western liberalism, a political tradition whose roots Strauss traces back not to the Enlightenment or to the revolutions of the 18th century, but all the way back to the ancients, particularly Greece, and particularly Plato, in whom Strauss finds the most highly developed model of natural rights and civic virtue in all the canons of political philosophy. For Strauss, Western modernity, and particularly the 20th century, is a history of entropic decline into nihilism in the liberal tradition, brought about, he contends, by the spread of permissive egalitarianism, by pernicious doctrines of universal rights and entitlements, and above all, brought about by the corrosive influence of relativism in all its forms, under whose influence, Strauss suggests, we witness the destruction of moral truth, and with it, the destruction of virtue. From this base, Strauss set out to uncover the traditions in modern liberal philosophy that lead us to this point, using the classical political philosophy of the ancients as a yardstick against which to measure the poverty, as he saw it, of contemporary 20th century liberalism. As another key figure in neoconservative intellectual history, Irving Kristol, put it, Strauss turned one's intellectual universe upside down. Suddenly, one realised that one had been looking at the history of Western political thought through the wrong end of the telescope. Instead of looking down at them from the high vantage point of our more advanced era, Strauss trained his students to look at modernity through the eyes of the ancients and the pre-moderns, accepting the premise that they were wiser and more insightful than we are. One read them in order to understand ourselves, products of the modern age, better than we were able to do so on our own. The influence of Strauss is very clear, I think, in post-9/11 neocon polemics, like, for example, this one. This is a different Kristol, Irving Kristol's son. The War Over Iraq, Saddam's Tyranny and America's Mission, by Kaplan and William Kristol, a book in which moral relativism is equated with the weak and apologetic Americanism of Bill Clinton, and where the absolute moral virtue of the Bush Doctrine is guaranteed because it derives from, quote, our founding values, and thus derives from a virtuous moment in history before the corrosive entropy of moral relativism sets in. The original moment of pure absolute truth and virtue is different here. In Strauss, it's ancient Greece. In Kaplan and Kristol, it's our founding values. But the argument about entropy and how to reverse it is the same, as is the model of looking at history from the other end of the telescope, using the wisdom and virtue of moral absolutes from the past to gauge the wisdomlessness and virtuelessness of a present mired in relativism. Given the Rhodes' extended meditation on entropy and cultural sterility on one hand, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning quality of the prose on the other, I wonder if we might find something analogous to Strauss's re-telescoping of history in the road. I certainly think we might see something more or less analogous at the level of language in the shifts in register that punctuate the novel. Longer-term readers of McCarthy will be familiar with these shifts. Like his treatment of violence, they've shaped McCarthy's style for decades in the juxtaposition of spare, flat realism with words, phrases, or entire passages sketched in McCarthy's signature borrowings from Melville or Faulkner or the King James Bible. In The Road, the contrast between what is conventionally described as McCarthy's plain style and his high style is particularly marked, I think, because of the preponderance in the narrative of the sparse, Hemingway-esque realism that has increasingly shaped McCarthy's later work. When the high style arrives in The Road, it does so in particularly obtrusive, disjunctive ways. Cannonading, rachitic, catamites, mendicant, envacuuming, something nameless in the night, load or matrix to which he and the stars were common satellite, like the great pendulum in its rotunda scribing through the long day movements of the universe, of which you may say it knows nothing, and yet know it must. These fragments of arcane language and phrasing are carefully chosen and placed. They add linguistic weight and depth to the prose, and they generate intellectual rather than sentimental effects among readers. Most important, perhaps, is the quality of pastness they invoke, the sense of belonging to a past which is undefined and open-ended, but whose significance lies less in their historical specificity or lack of it, and more in the contrast they provide with a narrative present characterised, the novel tells us, by linguistic entropy and the creeping death of language. Dropped into a context of chronic entropy, McCarthy's arcana approximate a return to a moment when language itself seems richer, more complex, more cultured, more capable of carrying truth, and thus, in Straussian terms, more capable of embodying virtue. Imagine one of these moments in a physical, visual form, as a 3D pictogram, perhaps, or as a physical object. I see it as a funnel with the arcana, when they appear, opening sinkholes in the text, draining the entropy of the now from the narrative as the reader is gripped momentarily by a linguistic remnant or trace or aftershock of a superior civilization, a funneling out of an acculturated present back into a richer past of nuance and sophistication. An alternative way of visualizing this, perhaps, might be to think of it in Straussian terms, as a telescope viewed through the wrong end, through which momentarily, in the flashing of McCarthy's arcana, we might glimpse lost fragments of language against which the entropic linguistic standards of the present might be evaluated and judged. Much has been made over the years about the aesthetics of McCarthy's shifts in register between high and plain styles, but there's been very little discussion about the politics these shifts might entail. Thinking about these shifts in relation to the post-9/11 neocon structure of feeling might allow us to begin thinking politically about this aspect of McCarthy's work. And once again, I think there is a clear parallel between McCarthy's project and the neoconservative project. Asserting the importance of memory in a world fading from memory is a key theme in The Road, just as asserting the importance of memory in a world that has forgotten its virtuous, truthful past is key to what Leo Strauss is doing, just as it is for the post-9/11 neocons in their lionising of what they call the founding values of the Republic, lost or betrayed or watered down, they argue, by a generation of weak, apologetic, relativist, amoral foreign policy. Considered in these terms, and within their historical context, I don't think it's too much of a leap to make to describe McCarthy's register shifts in The Road as something like a neocon aesthetic that embodies, albeit in highly mediated ways, a neoconservative structure of feeling. The final issue I'd like to address before I wrap this up takes us back, first of all, to Leo Strauss and to one of the more interesting tensions in his work and in post-9/11 neoconservatism, an awkward tension, a balancing act between virtuous truth and moral absolutism on one hand and pure pragmatism on the other. After 9/11, and particularly after the invasion of Iraq, this was an issue that was quite widely discussed for a while anyway, in the context of what Strauss views as the noble lie, an idea Strauss extrapolates from Plato, and an idea which contemporary Straussians like Donald Rumsfeld's deputy at the Pentagon, Paul Wolfowitz, extrapolate in turn from Strauss. In Straussian political theory, the need for noble lies derives from the relationships he posits between wisdom, truth, virtue, and power. For Strauss, only the truly wise, those capable of knowing absolute truth, are capable of governing virtuously. And so power and privilege accrue to educated elites as a matter of natural right. The uneducated mob, lacking both the wisdom required to understand truth and the ability to act virtuously in the face of it, they must be shielded from truth, partly for their own good, but also in the interests of preserving the stability and integrity of the metropolis, both of which may be threatened if alarming truths are made openly accessible to the wisdomless and the virtueless. In Straussian theory, governing elites can lie to their people with impunity in the name of defending truth and virtue and social cohesion, and they can do so justifiably, not just on an occasional ad hoc basis, but as a routine tool of governance. The noble lie is also necessary in Strauss to protect the virtue of the wise. Their wisdom is itself an absolute truth. It is what gives the wise their natural right to a place at the top of the pile, and that vantage point of truth and virtue and power is to be defended at all costs by any means necessary, including the spinning of lies to a populace unable to cope with truth. In Straussian political philosophy, then, lies are necessary to secure truth. Defence of absolute values demands pragmatism. This awkward and rather contradictory neocon proposition about the virtuous truth of noble lies spills over in very direct ways, it was suggested at the time, into post-9/11 neoconservatism, in the exaggeration of terror threats, in the calculated campaign led by the White House to link 9/11 to Saddam Hussein, in the claims about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and in the pulling of all these things together into a rhetoric of national mission which bonds Americans together, at least according to the neocons, into a unified, stable, and cohesive mass. How might we trace this awkward balancing of pragmatism and absolute virtue in the road? The story the father tells the child and the story he tells himself about good guys carrying the fire might be one way. In an amoral universe utterly transformed by the terror of the post-apocalypse and by the final stages of catastrophic entropy, the trope of good guys carrying the fire rings rather hollow, an archaic hangover from moral codes, perhaps, that no longer have any obvious relevance or meaning. But if good guys carrying the fire is a fabrication or a lie, it is a lie with distinctly noble aims, and it's an idea that has considerable Straussian traction in the narrative. It helps keep the child going when the truth might cause him to fail. It helps keep his hope alive. And it also feeds and reinforces the cohesion of the bond between he and his father. More interesting, perhaps, because it is more pervasive in the book and more pervasive in the post-9/11 neocon structure of feeling, is the awkward balancing of pragmatism and virtue that is absolutely central to the relationship between the father and the child. It's commonly assumed that because the child is presented to us by the father as a figure of virtue and redemption, then it must be the child that provides the moral core of the novel. This is a persuasive argument, not least because it meshes quite neatly with moments in McCarthy's earlier work, particularly perhaps in the Border Trilogy, where if redemption exists at all, it does so as Chip Arnold, I wish he was here, once suggested, redemption in the trilogy exists in small acts of kindness, moments of generosity to others that certainly appear to be in a lineage of some kind with the civic virtue of the child in the road. What I'd like to suggest, however, so perhaps it's a good job that Chip isn't here, is that the moral core of this book lies not in the child, but in the father, or at least in the sometimes tense and conflicted spaces that lie between the two of them. It isn't the child's occasional objections to the pragmatism of the father that form the moral core of the road. It's the father's overriding of those objections in the facing down of existential threats. The child may embody something akin to pure virtue, but without the pure pragmatism of the father, that virtue cannot be defended or secured or delivered at the end of the book. Very much in the manner of a Strauss or a Wolfowitz, or alternatively, very much in the manner of the post-9/11 neocon defence of torture. Without the pragmatism of the father, there can be no virtue, no absolute truth to deliver. Once again, I would argue, in its extended meditation on the tense and awkward but necessary relationship between pragmatic actions and absolute truth, The Road is a novel which embodies in quite direct ways the neocon structure of feeling that prevails in the US during the early years of the War on Terror. I'll just take a minute to finish now by stressing that I don't intend this reading of The Road to be a closing down of other possible readings, including those readings which have attributed to the book a more liberal, sometimes even a radical, politics. The Road has been read as a deep ecology fable about the planet's rejection of the human race. It's been seen as a warning about the consequences of nuclear proliferation. It's been read in a variety of ways as a refusal of American exceptionalism. And it can certainly be seen, I think, in its hollowing out of the generic road narrative as a meditation on the limits and mutability of mainstream American iconography. In each of these ways, and I dare say in many others, The Road is a novel which can accommodate in quite straightforward ways the liberal politics which liberal readers might bring with them to the act of reading the book. The reading I've presented here is offered very deliberately as one possible reading among others, and the very fact that McCarthy's prose can accommodate such a wide range of responses from readers is surely part of what makes him such a vital and significant voice. McCarthy's art is art which positively bristles with the tensions, conflicts, and contradictions of his age in a manner that few writers of his generation can match. But I do think that the critical tendency among some liberal critics to assume that McCarthy is by default one of us is a dangerous assumption to make. Across the spectrum, the temper of the post-9/11 period has often been one of intense revisionism. And one of the things this paper has tried to do is to suggest that Cormac McCarthy, however much we love him, should not necessarily be immune from that temper. Thank you.